It has real meat. It just has salt.
Yeah.
We're discussing tamales back here. The wailing and gnashing of teeth begins. Of course, Alex closed my notes. I say two people are already leaving, man. We'll go ahead and give you the disclaimer that Travis is not gonna be here Sunday, so you get a three-peat of me teaching. If you plan to be sick, it might be a good time to do that. So, let's see, who did I ask last time? Mitch, you mind leading us in a word of prayer before we start? Thank you.
Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ, through whose blood we have this opportunity to approach your throne. Pray, Father, that you guard our hearts and guide our minds as we study your word and help us to be what you have us to be. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Okay, so we're in 19 and 20. We're just moving right along through 1 Samuel, or Samuel Part A. So what happened in the last ones? Last one we talked about, 17, 18 last time? What happened then? 16, 17, 18, right? Was it three chapters? Yeah. 16, 17, what happened? Give me a quick synopsis, like where are we standing right now in Samuel at the beginning of chapter 19? And it can't be Travis because he taught it. David was anointed, yeah. Killed Goliath, yeah. Round and around and around and around. We're going to sing the song. David one little stone went.
Saul kills thousands, David kills 10,000.
Yeah, which I was like, that song, One Little Stone, if you actually have ever seen where they're pretty sure this battle took place and where the brook is, there aren't small stones there. These stones are softball size. and so when it says it sank into his forehead, it ain't talking about like, bink, like a little clean bullet hole you see in TV shows when somebody gets shot. I always think back to the Goonies, you know, when they get the guy out of the freezer and he's been shot in the forehead, there's a little dot right there. But it's like, I mean, it's even if he's huge, it's still a big honking rock. So, killed Goliath, what else? 10,000, killed a bunch more, yeah.
Jonathan and David became close friends.
Yeah, Jonathan and David become close friends. They make a couple oaths with each other, which we're going to see some like remindings of those oaths, and we're going to talk about what is like important about those. Okay, anything else we should remember?
Married Saul's daughter.
Married Saul's daughter, yep. Okay. Saul went crazy. Yeah, and we're going to see, we're going to talk about some of that later here in a second, because there's going to be some sort of like ebb and flow of that. And there's some really interesting, I'd found a book and I'd read the synopsis of it and then my computer restarted and I lost my tabs and I went back to history and I just couldn't find it. But it's about mental health in the Bible, and it talks about Saul and like what did that look like. And David, when he was writing the Psalms, and there's obviously some like depression language going on there. And it's really neat. This guy sort of looks at it and does sort of like a psychoanalysis of it all and talks about some of that stuff. Interesting, though. So here we are. We're in Samuel 19. We're going to start there. This is another one of those where 20 is sort of a long chapter, but they're sort of repeating themselves a whole bunch, and so we're going to spend a little more time in 19 probably as we go through. Being the geography nerd that I am, I'm totally going to put some geography context into this, and I found a really cool website where this guy who travels the Holy Land takes panoramic pictures from a place where things have happened, and then he's like, okay, this is where this happened. That little dot in the out there is this, and this is this, and this is this. And he tells you how far away it is, and it really puts it into perspective that when it talks about David fled, ran, at one point it's 7 kilometers that we're going to talk about here, which is how many miles for our freedom units? I mean, 7 miles. I just always go 2 to 1, right? So it's, 3.5 miles? And the pictures will show that. They're sort of hard to see because they are panoramic, and I put them on this screen, but we'll go from there. Okay, so verses 1 through 7, Jonathan helps David. So it's a little context here. This is sort of an aside, I guess, when you really look at it. What are you all's subheadings say here? Mine says Saul tries to kill David, and I'm using it in the NIV.
David protected from Saul.
And so I used some of those. I switched this one because this is really about Jonathan helping David. So the first line sort of sets it up, right? Saul told his son Jonathan and all of the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan had taken a great liking to David and warned him. And he says, My father Saul is looking at a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there. I will go out and stand with my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to him about you and will tell you what I find out. I think it's interesting that he says to go hide, but I'm going to go with him and be in the same field that you are so you can sort of overhear this, or I'll come tell you later. That's one of those facts that I was looking. I was like, I'd like to know more. Like, what did they have, a prearranged meeting place? Is there a place where Saul would be like, I bet David's here. I'm going to go look here. And it's sort of like when you're helping kids with Easter egg hunt, right? Oh, look over there. Do you see it? And there's really a pile over here. You're trying to get to the little kids and trying to distract them the whole time. So, he spoke well of David. And in verse 4, it starts with, in about middle of the verse, do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. So he's just laying out the argument, right? He's like, look, this guy's helped us. What is your problem? Why are you trying to kill him? And then, this is sort of like that masterclass in making a case, because he lays it out. Here's my first point. He's been helpful with us, right? He hasn't sinned against you. He's helped you. And then he's even going to say, for he took his life in his hand, struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without cause? So he says, hey, look, he helped us. You saw it happen. So he gave us his claim, then he gave us his evidence, and then he's making it personal, right? You saw it. It helped you. You rejoiced at it. Why are you going to kill this guy? Right? So is there a moratorium against Saul killing David? Would Saul have the right to kill citizens under certain circumstances?
He's the king.
So yeah, in the path of justice, he would have the right to mete out that justice. But the main argument that Jonathan's making here is what? He hadn't done anything. Right? And a couple times you're going to see in the text, we don't get into it too deep, David says, if I've done something wrong, kill me yourself. I'll let you kill me, Jonathan. And then Jonathan says a few times back, if you're guilty, I'll kill you. And it's interesting that he's willing to take that on. And I think that's sort of the juxtaposition once again that we see where Saul never really owns up to anything stupid he does. And he blames everybody else. And David and Jonathan are both, I'll do it myself if that's the case. If it's warranted, I'll totally do it. And I think that's something we're going to see. So He goes on, he said, Saul listened to Jonathan and took his oath, as surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death. So once again, Saul makes an oath that he's going to totally keep, right? Yeah, he's totally going to do this. Yeah. What's that?
For one whole verse.
Yeah. Well, we don't know. It could have been like 17 years. You never know. No, it's not. I'm just telling you. So Jonathan called David and told him the whole conversation. He brought him to Saul, and David was with Saul as before. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly. What's that mean? So what was in his presence earlier? Like, what was he doing for Saul?
He was playing the harp.
Okay. The lyre. Yeah. What else was he doing?
He was his son-in-law.
Yeah.
He was leading his armies.
His mighty men of valor. Yeah. Okay. He was also doing what? Carrying his armor at some point, right? David was his armor bearer, which is a bodyguard kind of thing, like we talked about earlier. So verses 8 through 10, he was in his presence as before. And David has great success against the Philistines. So he is leading his armies. He's going out and he's killing people left and right. He's just smiting the donkey stuff and out all the Philistines, right? Left and right, taking care of everybody. We have other records of that in other books where it lays out some more of the details of what David's exploits were. And it's pretty interesting. So David is playing music. And Saul tries to pin him to the wall. Okay, that's the long and short of it. All we really have here is a couple things, which is interesting, and I sort of want to spend a little time camped out in these verses, or in this one verse, where it says in verse 9, but an evil spirit from the Lord was on Saul as he was sitting in his house with a spear in his hand. That's troubling. That's hard to read. Because at first glance, what does that verse say?
The Lord sent that evil spirit.
Yeah, the Lord sent that evil spirit to Saul and made him do it. That is a basic, to me, that's a basic reading comprehension of that verse. I think you'd be hard pressed not to hand this to somebody who's never read this before and be like, means what it says what it means, right? So what does it mean? That's my first question. How many of you actually, and I'll be honest, I probably spent, of the 5 or 6 hours I've spent on this, I probably spent about 2 just in these 3 verses. Just digging in and trying to figure it out, because it doesn't. It really is one of those where you're like, But there's a couple of verses we'll throw in there that'll sort of work there.
To me, it's reminiscent of when he first went heart.
Okay, when you harden, okay. Yeah, is there? Yeah, and it is sort of hard to process. Anybody else got anything? Stephen looks like he wants to say something. He's pontificating.
Yeah, I underlined this verse the moment I read it with the same questions. It's interesting that this evil spirit or this downtrodden spirit is on Saul, and the spirit of the Lord is on David to play the harp to raise his spirit. So there's like the good spirit and the bad spirit, and
taking back to Looney Tunes when you got the two, like, devil and the angel on your shoulders. Yeah.
David's ability to raise Saul's spirit is because he has the spirit of God.
These
things are in contrast here.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that that is there. Once again, you're seeing the depiction of Saul, who they begged for, who is making every dumb decision, but still making success. I mean, could we argue, is Saul successful as a leader? You really can't say he's not, because they have great victories. They're extending their areas. They're defeating the Philistines, not all the way, but they're defeating the Philistines. So he's successful, but is he?
He delegates well.
Okay. Yeah, but even then, his own son, remember 3 chapters back, is like, "That was dumb. Why did you swear that we wouldn't eat? Well, now we can't finish this job, and all the people are sinning because you made a silly choice." So as I dug in more, I really, a lot of the commentators and a lot of the people just throw it out to that Saul is already prone to jealousy here. Okay? We already know that Saul has an issue with David, right? Could we say that we know that he is definitely anti-David somehow, or he is worried about David? That he has that thought sort of going in his brain, right? Is he going to give David the benefit of the doubt?
No.
I don't think he will. And I think that that's going to come into play here in a second. I think that shows a lack of control. And he knows this hasn't been an issue before. So should he be able to handle this? If I know I have a problem with X, and I intentionally put X in close proximity to myself, should I at least have a plan to deal with it if that stuff comes back up again? I think so. I mean, that's a smart thing to do. And I think this shows a lack of wisdom control on Saul's part, that he can't recognize the flaw he has in himself. Now, I'm not saying he should kick David out and not have him around. Obviously, David's a good guy to have around for him. I think it shows a lack of control on his own part to say, you know what, I know this is going to be a problem. And how many of you all, that's as long as you admit that you know you're going to have that problem, you can usually avoid it. That's just the reality of it. If you're not, you can plan, you know. I think it also shows a lack of judgment on his part, on Saul's part, that's there. But also, James 3:16 is something that is really important, and I put it up there. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. So does this spirit, evil spirit, actually come from the Lord? Did God send a for real evil spirit to him, or is that just a turn of phrase?
I think the Lord allowed it.
Okay.
Cain referred to, Pharaoh and the hardening of his heart. You think about Judas Iscariot and how he was already helping himself to the treasury whenever Satan entered his heart. I was thinking about Romans 1:28. It says, they did not see fit to acknowledge God. God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. If you are that determined to do wrong, then God is not going to shield and protect you from these evil spirits.
Yeah. And I think the best explanation that I saw sort of piggybacks on that, to where literally when it says an evil spirit from the Lord, all that's referring to is that it is something beyond human grasping. There is something there that is supernatural, beyond like mental going on, that they just don't know why, but Saul hates this guy, right? There's something going on there. And from the Lord, there are other examples in the Old Testament where it says this is from the Lord, just meaning that it's there. It's part of it, if that makes sense. Does that? They following on that?
I'm just wondering if, instead of an actual evil spirit inhabiting Saul, perhaps it was more of a spirit of evil within Saul.
Sure.
His own spirit was bent on evil.
Yeah. I agree. Anything else on that one? That was rough. That was a hard thing to dig through for a little while. Yeah. So some would argue that there is probably a little mental, like there are some people who dig into that stuff. Once again, can we know that? No. Can we put pieces together and say this is likely? We can. I think that's possible. You can totally do that. And it is one of those things where as we look back, hindsight is sort of 20/20 kind of things, and the advances we have in psychiatric like care and being able to look and being like, okay, that's probably what this is. He's definitely got narcissistic tendencies, right? He definitely has some kind of personality stuff going on. But can we say that with certainty? Yeah.
I was listening to a sermon last week talking about evil spirits and demons. And I do not recall the verse he referred to, but there's a verse that basically talks about ailments, conditions, and spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And it says he differentiates.
Yeah.
He said we probably tend to oversimplify and say, well, he was just mentally ill. It may very well be he was mentally ill, but it also may very well be that there was a demon or some evil spirit that also took up residence in him And it's probably easier for us to oversimplify and explain away things that we understand.
Yeah.
We don't understand the spiritual realm.
Yeah. And to me, this is one of those verses where sometimes you just got to go, and then just sort of move on. When we teach the high school class, that was what's that? I don't know. When we teach the high school class, Matt and I and Matt Mayo and I taught last time, and we'll tell the kids, you can ask us anything, but just understand if you ask us a question we're not ready to answer, we'll go, I don't know. Let me get back to you. Give me like till Sunday, and let me see what we can come up with. And sometimes there were times we'd come back with an answer and just be like, there's people who say this, there's people who say this, there's people who say this. There's no general consensus. And then we would ask the big question, is it a salvation issue? And the question, usually if the question answer to that question is no, there's going to be different opinions. Okay. So, yeah.
This is the third verse like this so far in Samuel.
Yeah.
Back in 16, verse 14, and then 18, verse 10, say very similar things.
Yeah. Just because of the consistency of it, like the consistency of he's got something going on. Okay, so Michael steps in to protect David, verses 11 through 17. And this is some other deep stuff here. We'll go pretty quick. So David goes home, right? Because goes to his house. And what happens in these verses? Let's just summarize it real quick. Saul sends guys to his house, right? It says Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and kill him in the morning. So go watch. When he comes out, kill him. But Michal, David's wife, warned him, right? And what does she say to him?
She tells him to leave.
Yeah. This one, the translation I have says, if you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed. The other translation that I was reading before working on notes said, if you don't save your life tonight, tomorrow you're going to lose it. So go. Like, I love those little turn of phrases where instead of just being like, hey, you might want to run away, they're like, you should do this because this. Sort of that different switch there. What did they do? What did they come up with? Yeah, this is also, I love the best part is Michal states the obvious. You should probably run away. My dad's trying to kill you. And David's like, I just wonder, why did David go home in the first place? You know, he just almost got speared to the wall. And he goes home where people would find him. So that's sort of interesting. And if you want an interesting word study, look at that pinned to the wall phrase and what that means. There's a whole bunch of people who have written a whole bunch of stuff, but they can't get really into it. So Michal states the obvious, hey, you better run or you're going to die. So what's this part where it says, then Michal took an idol, or the household idol is what the translated word is, and laid it on the bed, covering it with a garment and putting some goat's hair at the head. Is there anything troubling there for anybody?
The household
idol. Yeah, did anybody else read that and be like, what? Because that was one of those I read and I was like, huh? First of all, I got the vision of Ferris Bueller's Day Off with like him laying in the bed, right? And he opens the door and it does all the stuff. That's totally what I got in my brain. So he gets that, right? What is this household idol? Yeah, so I brought that word up earlier. Terra meaning earth. Fem meaning, I don't know what fem. Where do you hear fem a whole bunch? Sarah, fem, yeah, right? So this is, teraphim is basically just means like.
Earth angel.
Earth model, earth, yeah, good job. But fem also means like holy, so like holy on earth, something like that. So there's a whole bunch of debate about this. Most of the historians say that because this is not a whole, like they are not a completely Yahweh worshiping group right now, that there are other idolatry going on at the time. We know it from Saul. We know it from a bunch of these other people, that this is, may or may not be a holdover from some other stuff. Time out on that. I'm going to come back to that because I forgot this one. The other time this is used is the story of Rachel. When Rachel steals something, she steals a teraphim from who?
Dad.
From her dad, hides it in her camel's like sack, right? And then he comes to look for it, and she says, I can't get up. I'm unclean. Okay? And he's, and then he goes, okay, and then goes and looks everywhere else and then can't find it, right? But this is the same thing, the household gods. And Laban comes out and says, why have you stolen my gods from me? And so there's some interesting stuff with this. Most historians would argue this is carryover from other religions and that it may or may not have been Yahweh, okay, of Yahweh. It may not have been a statue of God. But what, again, would we, where would we see the problems with this? I'll give, yeah, so there's no real telling. And this is sort of where we get the glimpse that, you know, as you're a kid, you pretty much learn, oh, they're Jews. They're all following the law. They're following the law exactly. All these guys are doing the law exactly. It's not how it was. All these guys are doing completely other things and bringing in things from other religions and all that stuff. And this is one of those times where we see that. It's about 50-50 whether this was either Yahweh or something else. By the way, the one with Rachel was small enough to be hidden in a camel's saddlebag, so basketball or smaller. This one is big enough to be considered a 5'5" guy. So there are different sizes. There's no real telling. That's another one of those things. I'd love to know, what was it? Like, what statue was this? Was it like a Baal thing? Was it Yahweh? Was it
something whatever she brought, or was it David's?
Because it's his household, yeah. Which is interesting. And there's not a negative connotation swung with it. Like when it talks about, when in Old Testament, when it talks about idols, it has different use of the word. Like there's different like negative connotations that was always put with it versus now when it just says, hey, they just had a household idol. Here you go. So Michael lies to Saul. He said he would kill me. He says, why'd you do this? Why are you helping out my enemy? And she wisely, in my opinion, says what? I didn't have a choice. He was going to kill me. I had to. This is one of those things, like I saw a sermon, I'm bookmarked, I want to go back and read it, but it talks about when lying is okay. And he talks about this verse as one of them and some of the other deceptions that David does in order to save himself or save certain things that happen. It was interesting, but this is sort of what I had pictured is, he said he'd kill me. And then she just sort of dramatically flops on the floor. Yeah, I don't know why that got stuck in my brain, but there's my humor for the class. Anything on that real quick? Okay, because it keeps distracting me about getting my eye. So 11 to 17, I might have forgot to change. Yeah, I forgot to change the numbers on this. This is actually through the end of the chapter. I did not change 11 and 17 there. Sorry about that. So it's 18 through 24. Yep. So David goes to Samuel. And I sort of picture him running up. He's like, look what Saul did to me. He tried to chuck a spear at me. And then three groups of messengers go to Samuel. And then Saul goes to Samuel. What's sort of fishy about that one, that statement? Think about three classes ago. What did it say after Samuel hewed Agag in parts? He never saw him again. So that's one of those contradictions people like to point out. When you read that in the original text, it is Samuel never went to Saul again. But what happens here? Saul goes to Samuel. And actually, there's going to be some interesting interactions here we'll see as we go through. So David flees to Ramah. Three groups go after him. I'm going to speed through this real quick. Each group begins to prophesy. Okay, remember, Samuel is leading these, and Ramah, he's leading this school for prophets, right? And all these people are learning and prophesying and teaching. And each group begins to prophesy. And Saul goes and does the same. In verse 23, it says, and the Spirit of God came upon him also, so that he went along prophesying continually until he came to Naoth in Ramah. So there's a whole bunch of stuff to read into this too about the Spirit of God being on him and not being on him, and anointing and then not on him, and all these like sort of interactions of how the Spirit lands on Saul. That's a whole book you could talk about, because there's just a lot to read there. I see Stephen sort of making a face like, I don't even want to. Verse 24, it says, yeah, and so I didn't bring that into here, but I do want to talk about that. So he stripped off his garments, and he too prophesied in Saul Samuel's presence. He laid naked all that day and all that night. This is why people say, is Saul among the prophets? But what's that a throwback to, the Saul among the prophets thing?
When he was first anointed.
He went and hung out, which one?
Chapter 10.
Yeah, chapter 10, he went 10, not Tim, 10, he went and hung out with the prophets and did the same thing. And so they're sort of repeating it. Are you sure he's not a prophet?
I don't remember him taking on a holiday.
Okay, so yeah, so that's one of those translations.
For a long time, wailing away.
Yeah. So this is one of... Yeah. This is one of those translations and spots where there are two ways to read it, that he took off his kingly vestments, and it is actually a sign that God no longer recognizes him as the true king, but he still is going to prophesy to him and still do all this work for him, prophesying, and he doesn't have his vestments. There are, once again, there's like a 50-50 thing here, that he was just naked, or that he was stripped down to his undergarments and had taken off his kingly vestments. So that there was, this is sort of almost the Spirit of God rebuking Saul to remove these trappings that you don't deserve anymore, man. They're not yours. Yeah, humbling him sort of as a little preface to what's going to continue to happen, what has been happening. So
think of Ezekiel laying naked and doing all that he did.
Yeah.
As a prophecy to the Jerusalem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and something else we need to remember about Old Testament and Old Testament sensibilities and our sensibilities, we have a very Victorian view of nudity and nakedness, right? Our view of nakedness is very much shaped by our society. Their view of nakedness is a little more loose than ours, okay? It would not... So even if he is naked, it's a thing. It's not necessarily, I'm just trying to say culturally there's going to be differences. Does that make sense? Great. Okay, I got to keep moving because I'm running out of time. So this is one of those sites that I found you. So 1967, King Hussein of Jordan built a palace at Gibeah of Saul. He did not get to finish that. Why? Yeah, because the 67 war, the Israelis sort of skedaddled everybody out of there. So he didn't get to finish it. But this is really interesting. So this is Gibeah of Saul. So this is where Saul would have been living, right? And if you can see, remember these two towers right here, okay? Those are important. And we're going to use those as a point of reference. So we're looking here at Gibeah of Saul, right here. And we are looking this way, okay? That's the Temple Mount, which is 5 kilometers away, 2.5 miles. So Jebus, which is what it's called then, or Jebus, which is going to become Jerusalem. So it's only that far away. What was it, Shiloh?
It used to be a tabernacle.
It used to be Ark. What happened after they got the donkey stuff and kicked out of them? Where'd they move the tabernacle? Nob, right? Called Place of the Priests. But was the Ark there? No, because the Ark is sitting where? About right here in where? Kiriath Jebeth, if you remember that. And then Gilgal. What's Gilgal again? It's where Saul was ordered to wait at the Standing Stones, right? And the Standing Stones are the stones that were placed by who? Right after they crossed the river? Right before they went and walked around a city for a while? That city is... Yeah, there you go. And Jericho is about right there. Okay, so that's interesting. But then this one is a little more interesting. I need to give you a little context. This tower is that tower. This walkway is that walkway, okay? So this thing, I wish I could have put it up all the way, because it's, what I did was I chopped it in half and then moved it down, okay? And I'm gonna have to tell you because you can't see it. So this is Nebi Samuel of Israel. This is the traditional burial place of Samuel. If you go there, it's a state park. You can go, and this is a crusader fortress that got built, and the burial place of Samuel is there, but they'll tell you, it's sort of like the log cabin over in Hodgenville, the ceremonial Lincoln's home, boyhood home that they know is not Lincoln's boyhood home. It's a cabin that was built around the same time, and they just moved there. So this is looking out, and once again, what you can see is the two towers that I brought up are right here. That's those two towers. And then the Temple Mount again is over here about 6 miles away. So I just thought that was an interesting sort of to give you a, so when you hear the, remember the verses when Samuel, Saul's lookouts looked and he saw the army dissolving before them. That's about what they're going to be seeing, seeing the multitude of people just fleeing because they were only about a mile away from each other. That's another one. I wish that we could do more of this geography study just to see how small the land is, right? Like, when David flees, he goes from Bowling Green to where? Maybe, yeah, Russellville. I was thinking Smith's Grove. Yeah, it's not very far. So we're going to go through this pretty quick. This is one of those, another one. There's a whole bunch here. David and Jonathan's covenant. David asks a question. I think this is sort of interesting in telling of Jonathan's sort of, I see Jonathan sort of just this wholesome, pure guy. He just wants everything to be cool. He just wants every, like he's, he just wants everything to be nice and happy and great. Because even though he knows his dad tried to throw a spear at David, his response to this is going to be like, are you sure? So what have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he is trying to kill me? And Jonathan, in a very shortened way, says, no way. And David says, yes way. It's totally happening. It's going to happen. This is it. And so let me bring this up because I want to read some of the things he says. Jonathan says, never, you are not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything great or small without letting me know. Why would he hide this from me? It isn't so. He just tried to stab him with a spear, right? And he's like, oh, it's not. He just maybe got a little angry. But David took an oath and said, your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes. And he said to himself, Jonathan must not know this or he will be grieved. And he goes on to talk about this is happening. There's only a step between me and death. I think that's interesting, and you're going to see some of that come up in Psalms when he talks about how close he is to death, and his relationship with that is there. I need to find this book, but there's a really interesting book where someone went through and took the Psalms of David and put them historically with where he would have wrote them, and it's interesting when you start to connect his events in his life with what he wrote about. If you're interested, I'll try to find that for you. So David said, look, tomorrow is the new moon feast. So he tells them this, but even then he tells them, you know, we're going to have to like, I need to convince you, right? And so what do they do? First of all, what's a new moon feast? Feast of the new moon, first day of the month, right? Because we use a solar calendar. They used a, okay, difference between solar calendars and lunar calendars. Lunar calendars, all of them are 28, all months are 28 months or days, okay? And it goes by the phases of the moon. Why is that important? Harvesting is easier using that. Lunar calendar, solar calendars don't really line up with that very easily. Plus, they don't have a Julian calendar yet like we have. So they go by lunar calendar. It's just easier. And traditionally, they would have the first day of the month would be the first new moon, right? And they would do feasts on those days. So he says, I'm supposed to be there. Go there and tell him that I'm not there and see what he says. So they sort of set up a test, right? My thing's got out of order. So plan number one was David goes missing and Jonathan says he went to Bethlehem for a sacrifice, right? So I'm not going to be there. I'm expected to be there. When I'm not there, just tell him I'm not there. Okay. And Saul's reaction is going to show where David stands, which once again, this is interesting to me because what was Jonathan's deal when he walked up to the Philistine camp? I'm going to give him a test. If they say something to me, we're going to go up and kill him. If they don't say anything to us, we're going to leave, right? So he's putting a lot of this into people's reactions and knowing how to respond at that moment, right? And I think that shows us a little more. So that's plan one, right? Plan two, and we're going to come back to Jonathan's oath in a second because it's interesting. They set up the plan and then they're going to have another plan, okay? So this plan and how he reacts is how we're going to do things. But actually, let's look at Jonathan's oath real quick. So he said, then Jonathan said to David, I swear by the Lord, the God of Israel, that I will surely sound out my father by this time the day after tomorrow. If he is favorably disposed to you, will I not send word and let you know? It's one of those rhetorical questions. The answer is yes. He's just using the question as a mode to get that across. But if my father intends to harm you, may the Lord deal with Jonathan. Be it ever so severely, if I do not let you know and send you away in peace. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. So, once again, I love the way they do oaths, where instead of hey, this bad stuff's going to happen to me if I don't do this. Okay, crisscross applesauce, or cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. Their effect of that is, may the Lord deal with me. And I think that shows Jonathan's heart again, that he is trusting in the Lord. He realizes that's the deal. But show me unfailing kindness like the Lord's kindness as long as I live, so that it may not be killed. Because what does Jonathan have to keep remembering?
David is taking his father's place.
David's taking not just his father's place.
His
he's
place.
Taking his place, yeah. And in traditional Eastern culture, in any kind of monarchical culture, if I take over the throne from Stephen's family, they all gonna die. Because they have to, because there can't be anybody to question the Quinn lineage, right?
That's reasonable.
Yeah, in our thinking, we're like, how vicious, that girl, you know, fainting again. But in their thinking, they thought, no, this is how it has to happen. It has to, right? It has to be this way, because we don't have stability. If we don't have stability, we don't eat, right? And it is a little more harsh. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. Jonathan admits that the families are troubled, right? That the relationship there is troubled. And he's like, hey, don't do this. What's David's response? What's he say? We don't know. Because it says... So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord call David's enemies to my account. And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he had loved him as he loved himself. We don't know what David's response is, but we know he agreed, right? He said, great, we're going to make a covenant between our houses, and it's going to stay intact. And does it stay intact? Michael's still alive later, right? After Jonathan and Saul are both dead. Mephibosheth, yeah. I threatened Aaron with once putting that on the birth certificate, like she was out too long. And she looked at the doctor and she was like, do not knock me out. That or Hamtramck, that's a family name, Hamtramck. So we do not have a Hamtramck yet. We won't either. So we're gonna go back to this plan. So they come with the plan, they come up with the first plan, and then they swear their oaths to each other, and then you can sort of see them like part ways, and they're like, oh, wait a second, how are we gonna tell each other like how this works? So the plan two is Jonathan will shoot arrows towards a rock where they land, shows David what's going on. If it's in front of the rock, it's all good. You don't have to run away. If it's behind the rock, run. Get to stepping, move. Okay? And it talks about how they went out to the place where David was known to sit, which to me does not make a lot of sense, because if he's known to sit there and somebody's trying to kill him, I'm not going to go there. That's just where I'm going to be. Okay, so the plan is enacted, and Saul chucks another spear, okay? I knew I was going to have to speed through this, so we're going to be pretty quick. So 24 to 34. The first night, Saul looks up, and it's, what does he say? David's not here. What's wrong with him? He's unclean. I bet he's unclean. He's just unclean tonight. The second night, what happens? Saul notices, and then 30, it says, Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan. I didn't want to get to that one yet. So in 28, it says, Jonathan answered David earnestly, asking me permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, let me go because my family is observing our sacrifice in the town, and my brother has ordered me to be there. I have found favor in your eyes. Let me get away to see my brothers. That is why he is not coming to the king's table. So once again, what did he do? He lied. There's a lot of questions on whether or not, what do you call it, a lie? Do you call it a stretching of the truth, however it needs to be? So in 30, Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan. He said to him, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and the shame of your mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send someone to bring him to me, for he must die. What's interesting about this? What name doesn't he use? David. He calls him the son of Jesse. Also, this son of a perverse woman, I just Googled that just to see like what it has to do with. And this is on the list of, like, there's somebody did this ranking, top 10 cuss outs in the Bible. And this is like number two. I don't remember what number one was. But this is, in effect, him saying, you stupid blankety blank. like, this is bad. Like, everybody at the party, it would have been like one of those like record scratch moments where everybody's like, ooh, something a little salty, fired up. So
the new moon feast is not going well.
No, it is not. So what does Jonathan do? Calls him out again at a feast in the palace. And he said, why should he be put to death? What has he done? I think it's interesting that, remember the first time he talked to him, he got a couple good sentences in. This one he says two sentences. He has two questions. But Saul hurled a spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. He's like, and so I bet he's like, ooh, okay, I get it. Point taken. And I think that's a good point. They're going to deliver it. There's a point here, but David wept the most. We don't hear a lot of what David says in this. It's a lot about Jonathan and his character and his job. But they said they kissed each other and wept, but David wept the most. And the way that he says goodbye to him, it's probably one of the, like, it's heartbreaking when you just think of how this went down. Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord is witness between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever. Then David left and Jonathan went back to town. And David will see Jonathan how many more times between now and then? One time before he's about to die, and David knows he's about to die. So this is like, as you read this, you're just like, oh, I just remember like saying goodbye to friends and just how heartbreaking it is. And by the way, that last sentence is actually number 21-1 in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it's one of those interesting things, like, why did they leave it in here? Why did they not put it in 21? But I'm teaching 21, so we already started 21. Jump start. Thank you, guys.
Well, what's funny is one of the commentaries that's like linked into it. He's like, this would be the equivalent of saying, you stupid son of a.
And a big stretch.
Don't bring my mama into this.
I'm glad I'm dealing with it.